know.
I'll tell you why. Because a man is suffering. Leave Marshawn Lynch alone, said a petition that circulated this week. And got a lot of signatures, too. Later this hour, you will meet someone who says, don't pity the Seahawks star running back. Marshawn is not who you think he is. We are talking right now to you on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, on Twitter, at KUOW. And I'm talking with my guests as we recap the news this week with Stranger Associate Editor Eli Sanders. Welcome back, Eli.
Nice to be here.
With Jonathan Martin, opinion writer at the Seattle Times. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi there.
Phyllis Fletcher is Managing Editor of the Northwest News Network. Hey, Phyllis.
Hey, now.
So I promise you vital, in-depth news and information this hour. But first, the biggest news out of Seattle this week, according to the world media, dog on a bus. You saw? You heard? The BBC, the Christian Science Monitor, Fox News, Huffington Post, NPR reported on this Como TV story about a black lab bull mastiff mix who you can find on a metro bus in Belltown.
She often roams the aisles of the D line looking for a seat and will hop up next to a stranger, which makes perfect sense for a dog who rides the bus alone.
She gets on and off by herself.
Yes, she does. And the video shows the dog sitting in the seat, licking the seat in front of her, and getting off at the Belltown Dog Park. The reason she's alone is her owner doesn't always get to finish his cigarette before the bus pulls up, so he lets the dog board and just catches up with her later. Adorable?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah?
I want to know if she has an Orca card.
Yeah, good question. Is that cute? The bus is packed, you're standing, the dog is sitting. Still adorable?
Yeah. I actually have had a contrary take to this whole... It sounds like the entire city loves the cute bus-riding dog, but I don't like dogs on the bus. I know that some dogs get to be on there because they're service animals and so on.
Okay. Hashtag not all dogs.
Not all dogs. I'll promote that hashtag.
Yeah.
However... if everyone starts bringing their dog or their self-professed genius dog that can ride the bus alone on the bus, I don't...
Because my dog is special.
Yes, I know.
Then there's the dog sees a cat and runs to her death. Hashtag not as adorable.
Oh.
Hopefully that won't... I mean, hopefully not. Okay, let's get into what I promised you. Our second story in order of importance this week. The Time magazine headline this week read... You'll never guess which state has the nation's most unfair taxes. The article says, when you think of states that hurt the poor and benefit the rich, ultra-progressive Washington state probably doesn't spring to mind. And yet, according to a new analysis, Washington's tax system is the most regressive in the nation, placing a disproportionate burden on those with the lowest incomes. So this week, when Governor Jay Inslee gave the new legislature his State of the State address, he talked inequality.
Our lowest paid workers pay nearly 17% of their income in taxes, while the top 1% pay less than 3%. A new teacher pays three times more in taxes as a percentage than our wealthiest citizens. Now, we know that there are many forces driving inequality. But we can make policy choices that move us toward an economy that works for all Washingtonians. We can work toward a fairer tax system, and we should this session.
Now, before we get into Governor Inslee's specific ideas, Jonathan Martin, Seattle Times, you've written about inequality this week and taxes. First of all, why is Washington State so regressive?
Washington State relies on sales tax, I think, more than any other state. And it's one of the few states that doesn't have either an income or a capital gains tax. So when you parcel out what everybody is spending, the proportion of, the groceries you spend and the everything that is taxed is far higher for people with lower income than higher income.
But it's not a flat tax. I mean, if you spend more money, you will pay more sales tax, just not a greater proportion of your income.
That's
right?
True. But people with higher incomes tend to buy more services than they do goods. And you think about the economic shift we've had since the sort of the post-industrial boom. And we're increasingly become a services economy. And in Washington State, sales tax does not apply to services. So that makes it the regressivity worse.
Okay, there'll be plenty more to say. Phyllis Fletcher, could you tell anything this week about whether these the taxes that the governor wants could pass?
Well, something just made it harder. So that is the state Senate. They passed a rule on themselves that any new taxes have to be passed by a supermajority. So that's a hurdle. It might sound familiar because voters passed something similar a few years ago. But
Tim Iman initiative,
yes,
right?
But that was overturned by the state Supreme Court.
So how does the state Senate get to do what the voters couldn't do?
Because it's a rule they voted for their own chamber.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
An internal rule.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Eli, any notes?
Well, I'm not, Phyllis probably knows more than me, but I haven't heard the convincing argument that what the Senate Republicans did is constitutional. If it is unconstitutional, according to the state Supreme Court, to require a two-thirds majority to raise taxes, then I don't quite see, and probably there's a loophole that I'm not aware of, I guess, if the Senate Republicans have really thought this through, but I don't see how it's constitutional now, if it wasn't in 2010, to create a constitutional majority requirement or a supermajority requirement, sorry, to raise taxes.
Are we saying, yes, John?
It is this is a bit inside baseball, but you think about the cloture requirements you hear about in the U.S. Senate, where you're required to have a 60% margin to bring something to the floor. This is not applying to the final vote. If it were applying to the final vote, then I think the constitutional argument that Eli raises would be valid. But what this is the internal process to basically bring a bill to final vote.
The backroom vote, so to speak. And I should correct myself. It was 2013 when the Supreme Court said this was unconstitutional if it was a floor vote. And perhaps they've found a way around it. If they just require two-thirds in the back room, then it's constitutional.
Governor Inslee is proposing a sort of cap-and-trade program on the carbon polluters and a capital gains tax. How much more progressive or less regressive would those two things make Washington State?
Well, one other thing on this, what the Senate did this week, they applied this rule to just new taxes. So existing taxes can still be bills can still be brought to a final vote with
more sales tax
majority.
Right.
Yeah, right, right. And that's one of the concerns, frankly, about what they did. They really bound the hands of the final deal budget writers when they're going to come to the final negotiated settlement for what's going to be a really tough budget. They just took two options off the table. And I think they did this basically to neutralize Jay Inslee. This was a elections have consequences type vote. Inslee campaigned very hard to get a Republican majority in the Senate. Didn't work. And first day of session, the Republican majority basically effectively killed Jay Inslee's two signature proposals this year.
It's also been pointed out that the people who killed this by creating this rule, a number of them get huge amounts of money, relatively speaking, in the legislature in campaign donations from oil and gas industries, which are not thrilled about the cap and trade bill or the carbon tax, as it's been called. And so that could be another reason that they're doing this. And yeah, like you've said, what they've left on the table now is the most regressive tax that we have. You can raise existing taxes theoretically, and so we can just head forward with our regressive tax system and hike it up even further. But we can't pass, realistically speaking, the carbon tax or the capital gains tax, which would do something to limit the amount of regressivity or just plain unfairness in our tax system. Reuven Carlisle, the finance chair in the House and a representative from Seattle, has looked at our tax system backward and forward over the years, and he recently called it in a Stranger editorial morally bankrupt.
So the legislative session just began this week. Are we saying it's all predetermined?
You know, the 2 years ago, the legislature was facing a big McCleary obligation.
This is the state Supreme Court saying you have to fund public education.
And they ended up, you know, patching together a budget that did raise a significant amount for education and didn't increase tuition, froze tuition at universities for the first time in forever, and didn't do harm or violence to the human services and corrections budget. I think that would certainly be the goal this year. The obligations, I think, are larger than they were 2 years ago. So how they're going to get there? I don't know. They're going to have to patch together something. The Senate rule did not preclude closing tax loopholes, tax preferences. Washington's tax code is basically a doily of loopholes, and
a lacy tax code.
Yes, see right through it. And so I think that the Senate rule would allow, since these are not new taxes, these are closing existing ones, that option, which I think would be a good way to start looking at at least some of the fairness in the tax code.
Phyllis, there was something this week about some Democrats putting a thumb in each other's eye.
Oh.
What happened?
This is so fun. So this was great. On Monday, I called my reporter, Austin Jenkins. All right, what do we got today? And he was like, oh, so exciting. And I was like, oh, really? And he instantly said, you haven't been reading my tweets, which was the big excitement that Democrats voted in a Republican lightning rod to be the Speaker pro tem, which is like a honorary type position. So the Republicans' choice had been Tim Sheldon, who had been a Democrat who had joined the Republican caucus, but Democrats then banded together to pick.
He's been a naughty Democrat.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. They wanted to give the spank. And so they banded together to pick Pam Roach, the Republican state senator from Auburn. And she's been known to go rogue, go libertarian, go off on people, so to speak.
Go firebrand.
Yes, she had been kicked out of the Republican caucus 5 years ago. She had been found to have been verbally abusive to people on her staff and to a Senate lawyer. So the kind of stuff that would make you say, oh, she's controversial.
Yeah. Okay, well, lots more to come. The legislative session has just begun. We'll keep following it. We are reviewing the top stories of the week, and a big thing came out this week asking, can non-natives ever be one of us? So we've been asking, what makes you a Northwesterner? Is it just about where you were born or where you live, or does something give you a true Northwest identity? So that's going on now at KUOW's Facebook page. Lexi says, on hot days in the Northwest, the kids all race undercover in the play court to get out of the heat. I was the same way as a Seattle kid 30 years ago. Tom says, after 15 years here, I've almost mastered the skill of walking down the street without making eye contact with anyone. We're going to talk later this hour in about 20 minutes with a Seattle writer who says, if you weren't born here, forget it. You'll never be one of us. And we'll hear more from you, too, from your Facebook page on KUOW's Week in Review with Eli Sanders, Jonathan Martin, and Phyllis Fletcher. Back in a moment. Catching you up on, smartening you up on, analyzing the week's news on KUOW's Week in Review. Good morning to you. This week, the French magazine Charlie Hebdo published its first issue since its offices were fatally attacked. And, once again, a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad was on the front cover. Neither the Seattle Times nor the Stranger ran the cartoon. Seattle Times' Jonathan Martin, why not?
Well, the thinking was that the cartoon is available, widely available on the web. So by describing what is in it, is describing what the news value of it is. If you want to go see it for yourself, you can go out on the web. And also that, you know, the Seattle Times is a newspaper that speaks to a broad audience, and there are constituencies that are legitimately offended, feel like they're legit religious beliefs were offended by this cartoon. It was intentionally being provocative. I mean, that's what Charlie Hebdo is. They're provocateurs. They're basically the kind of the Onion or the Mad Magazine in this realm.
Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger, your paper sometimes doesn't mind being offensive. Why no Prophet Muhammad in your paper?
Well, we do have Muhammad Ali on this week's cover.
Yes, you do.
That was the route that we took. And you know, I think it's worth reading because this is a very thorny issue, and it goes in so many different directions once you start talking about it. And not all of them are just the simple question of free speech or no free speech. But it's worth reading what Dan Savage put up on, I think it was January 8th, it looks like. He talks about how back in 2006, when he was running The Stranger's editorial department, he made a decision to put some of the controversial Danish cartoons in the paper that had depicted Muhammad, and how after this, he wasn't in a rush to remind people about it because I was afraid, he says. And so he talks in a really interesting way about the fear that the attacks inspired, but also the need to work through that. And so I think you can get, if you search for that post, you can get an interesting perspective on, you know, how one person navigated this paper. And I don't think we all had the same opinions as we talked about it. In fact, we definitely didn't. But, you know, this was the response that we came up with.
Do you want to share your own opinion?
Oh, you know, I had a hard time. Well, my own opinion on what? It depends on the question. What's the question?
Well, let's start with whether to publish that cartoon and then go on.
Republish the, yeah. Which cartoon?
This
from
week's, Hebdo? Yeah, the cover.
Oh,
from, the,
well, we mm-hmm. did, actually. We put that on our blog.
Mm.
So we did republish that one, the one with Muhammad crying,
yes.
And saying all is forgiven.
Yes.
Yeah. So okay. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
The place that I land with the whole Hebdo controversy is, of course, I support free speech and freedom of expression. Absolutely. At the same time, you know, I think it's worth asking yourself, I ask myself, is what I'm doing at a given moment the highest possible use of my freedom? And I don't have to agree with the value of what other people do with their free speech. That doesn't mean I don't support their right to free speech. That's where I land. It's hard to make a cover out of that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But isn't the whole point of the Charlie Hebdo attacks to squelch the free speech? And as a practitioner of the First Amendment in one of the country with the probably the most free press in the world, don't we have a duty to stand with the folks that were wanting to squelch it in France?
Well, then I look forward to the Seattle Times running the Hebdo covers. Mm.
Well, I don't run the Seattle Times.
Mm-hmm. By the way, today Pope Francis defended freedom of speech, calling it a fundamental human right, but said it must not cause offense. You cannot make provocations, he said. You cannot insult people's faith. If a great friend were to say something insulting against my mother, a punch awaits him, says Pope Francis. This is KUOW's Week in Review with Phyllis Fletcher, Eli Sanders.
I love this Pope.
And Jonathan Martin. You're into this Pope, huh?
I love this Pope.
Moving on as we analyze the top stories of the week. This week, Eli, one phrase echoed through the waterfront tunnel. Catastrophic failure, 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 failure. Who uttered those words and why?
Well, they were uttered very, very quietly. They were not even uttered, actually, at first. They were written in a report by some engineers who are contracted by the state to keep an eye on, or actually by Seattle Tunneling Partners, which is contracted with the state. But anyway, engineers on contract to keep an eye on the rescue pit for Bertha. Now, we're digging down 100 or so feet to get Bertha's cutter head off and maybe lift it up and repair it and put it back on, and then maybe she'll work again. Maybe. So these engineers said, the way that we're currently working on the repair pit risks catastrophic failure. And no one noticed this. This was on December 11th, I think, that they wrote these words. And no one noticed this until some people with the city got into a online sharing site that the state was using for tunnel-related documents, read this, and said, we should have been told about this.
And then it was just a draft, right?
It was a draft report that then, when the report went public, somehow the catastrophic failure phrasing was changed, edited out. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the city hadn't noticed it until they dug back and found the draft report. And so they asked a reasonable question. What changed between the draft report and the more publicly released report? You guys, if you're going to be communicating with us, should at least be telling us when you have a concern about some sort of catastrophic failure. And then let us know that it's been ameliorated, if it has.
One of the things I believe changed was the fact that they actually acted on the risk of the catastrophic failure and shored up the pit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a point-in-time fear that the way the pit was being built did have a risk of collapse, but the pit was shored up. You know, to me, this feels like a circular firing squad kind of action among bureaucrats. What you have is SDOT, Seattle Department of Transportation, and Washington State Department of Transportation arguing with each other about who is telling each other what. And to me, this is just a distraction from the basic issue with Bertha, is that the state bought a tunnel. It was a design-build contract. Seattle Tunnel Partners are on the hook and have already been paid a lot of money to deliver us a tunnel. Bertha is theirs. Bertha might be a lemon. They're figuring that out basically right now. But all this distraction about who's telling who what feels like it makes for good headlines. It's newsworthy, but it's a distraction from the issue. We have a multinational corporate entity partnership who's supposed to give us a tunnel. Their first crack at this has been a failure, but they're still on the hook for the tunnel. And once the pit is dug, once the cutter head is up and the thing is put back together, then let's see what happens.
For me, the basic issue is that Bertha doesn't work. And Pioneer Square has been settling a bit in some ways that are concerning. And the state had this moment, you're right, point-in-time concern, or engineers had a point-in-time concern about potential catastrophic failure in this tunnel, which is about 20 feet from the unstable viaduct, and didn't share that concern with the city, which is understandably concerned about all that's going on in connection with Bertha and Pioneer Square. Shama Sawant, the council member, had a kind of hyperbolic quote, but sort of summed up the fear, like, is Pioneer Square going to sink into Elliott Bay like Atlantis as a result of all of this? That's basically the fear. And if the state is not sharing, even if they're point-in-time concerns about catastrophic failure with the city, then the city has a right to be alarmed. And so, yes, this was in a draft report, but the council members, when they talked to the state about this several days after this, after they found out about the draft report and the letter was sent and all that, were reasonably angry with the state for not sharing the information earlier.
And Phyllis, hasn't the city of Seattle started its own study?
Right.
As if we don't trust your study? Was that the implication? What's going on?
Yeah, it's interesting. So they're going to have this study now, right? They're spending $150,000 to do their own like kind of fact vetting and is this really safe? You know, and you can't see the little air quotes I'm doing. But, you know, I mean, after so many years of, you know, people going out there with hard hats and putting on concern face and looking down at cracks, like there's clearly some concern that it's not safe, right? So I don't know what the chess game is. Like, what's now, am I posturing to sort of make you say it's unsafe? Like, what's the deal with that? What's up with that?
What is up with that? Not Bertha. Any final notes before we move on tunnel, viaduct, waterfront, settle, crack, stall?
You know, much of the concern about this, like I said, the circular firing squad between the bureaucrats, I think is pumped up by people who didn't like the tunnel in the first place. And now looking for a reason to say, look, we were right. The problem is that they're not right yet. The problem is that Bertha is going through a repair job right now that makes it late, probably makes it over expensive, but it's still possible. This is a bunch of corporate entities that have a tremendous amount of money, at least $500 million, and their corporate reputation's riding on this. And they have engineered a pretty amazing engineering fix if it works. Let's see if it works. If Bertha starts running again and makes daylight in South Lake Union, great. And if it doesn't, then that's the time to start having the Plan B discussion.
Eli Sanders requests a short rebuttal.
Your point is good. No one's been proven right yet. And I think you were suggesting that the moment when we find out who's right and wrong comes when they put the cutter head back on and Bertha does or does not start working again. And I would say, no, not exactly. Because say you get it back on and it starts working again, and then it drills, say, 2,000 feet, and it's under the federal building in downtown Seattle, the old federal building, and it stops working again. How are you going to rescue the thing then?
I move that we continue to discuss this almost every week on this program for the next 10 years. Well, this is KOW's Week in Review, and we'll keep at it. They're settling, but we can't settle it now. What makes you a Northwesterner? Is it about where you were born, where you live, or something else? Rebecca says, this is a conversation on our Facebook page. Rebecca says, Northwesterner, not owning an umbrella, having a lot of hats because you don't own an umbrella, having at least one tattoo, not owning a pair of high heels, driving a Subaru, knowing that black with black goes together, and loving animals. Because they hate animals in Omaha. No, I said that part. Katina says, Pacific Northwesterners will hike, ski, kayak, shop, eat, have sex, swim in the rain. They will also all claim that they know how to drive in the rain, but they actually don't do it well.
Is that all at the same time?
Some things we do well, I hope. And we're going to talk in a moment with a Seattle writer who says, if you weren't born here, forget it. You'll never be one of us. Coming up on The Week in Review. I love when our guests are still arguing when the microphone goes off and even when it comes back on. That's Eli Sanders jawing with Jonathan Martin, the stranger versus the Seattle Times. Here to referee, Phyllis Fletcher from Northwest News Network.
I'm the card girl.
You're the card girl? Uh-huh. Are you a local, are you a Northwest native?
Born at UW, okay.
Okay. Well, right. You know, if you weren't born in Seattle or the Northwest, you'll never be one of us, says Seattle Times writer Ron Judd in a column this week. He lays out what it means to be a Northwest native in what he calls the Northwest Manifesto. Ron Judd, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good morning.
What does the Northwest native have that an immigrant slash newcomer can never have?
Well, speaking just for myself, I guess the innate ability to tick people off by making broad, sweeping proclamations.
You did that this week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I kind of did that on purpose, you know, to start a discussion about differences between people who are of this place and people who aren't. And I was informed rather strongly by a lot of people that just discussing the otherness of people implies less than or worse than in a lot of ways, which I didn't really say, but that kind of became the conversation pretty quickly.
Yes, it did. So before we get to that, will you sort of give us a rundown of, for those who haven't read it, what do you mean by, you could pass for a native, but you're not? A native is what?
A native, you know, the point of this story was to just to sort of, you know, throw out there for all the huge numbers of newcomers here who come here and overwhelmed us and outnumber us by a broad margin, mm-hmm. the things that we see about ourselves that we hold to be important, things that we need, you know, things like cover. We appreciate being able to get the obscure and be out of the line of sight of people because of the natural cover around here. We like the rain. We like, you know, all the stereotypical things that Northwesterners sort of embrace, either people who were born here or people who came here accidentally or on purpose and got to like those things. So I laid that out, you know, just as a list of things that we like, things that we believe in, you know, the Northwest sense that we all sort of grew up in a place where everybody kind of minded their own business and went about their thing, and there was a big middle class here and all of those things that are now gone. And just the things that you would expect, you know, as a person who's been around here. But since there are so many people who haven't been around here, we thought, as the magazine at the Seattle Times, a good way to start a discussion about how we move forward all together is to at least understand the old way of thinking.
Well, let's go to a Northwest native. Phyllis, you're born in Seattle. How did you react?
Well, there were a lot of things definitely that Ron talked about that do not apply to me whatsoever and did not in my childhood at all. And so it's, you know, I get that Ron's saying, oh, just because I'm saying you're not in the gang doesn't mean that I'm saying you're less than. But come on now, man. If people said, oh, you can't play with me, that felt like, yeah, that's pretty much less than.
How did you not fit the Ron Judd gang?
Well, I grew up in poverty. So I grew up without a car in the home and never left the city limits except with YMCA day camp. And I hate all that outdoorsy stuff, man. Sorry, everybody I work with or everyone I've ever met. But, you know, the outdoorsy thing, I don't get it. You know, sorry, person I married. Sorry, son I'm raising. I don't connect to that whole nature thing whatsoever.
But aren't the outdoors free? I mean, yeah, you could spend a lot of money going outdoors,
yeah,
and we do. But
people are talking about like trail hiking and rural experiences and camping and things like that. We had no car, so that was just completely off the table.
The outdoors.
So all of my experiences.
But surviving it and getting there is not free.
Right. Yeah, right.
Eli, you were born here too.
Yeah, born at Group Health on Capitol Hill.
What are you thinking?
I've got a question for Ron Judd, which is, okay, newcomers, fine, but when they have babies, which they're doing already, are the babies born to people who don't fit his description of a native natives? What makes you a native that you were born in a hospital in Seattle?
Yeah, they're natives. And by, you know, the first part of that story, I was intentionally using an exclusive definition, a dictionary definition, a harsh definition, that you're not technically a native unless you're born here. And I was using that as a send-up sort of our own, the native's proclivity to sort of, you know, almost snobbish proclivity to go, well, I was born here. You know, people didn't get the humor in that. I obviously wouldn't make the argument that somebody who's lived here their whole life is not going to share any of the traits and that the rest of the people around here do.
And in fact, you might have come here because you do love that stuff about the, you know, the mountains and the salmon, and you actually chose to come here if you're an immigrant. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, and I was making the point that people who are born here now, of people who don't share those traits, you know, obviously maybe they will embrace some of them, maybe they won't, but I think there's a higher chance that they will if they spend all their days here, at least a lot of their formative years here in the same place, where all of those physical factors that sort of engender some of those beliefs.
But I want to talk about that immigrant thing for a second, because if you came here as a child of immigrants, or if you're a child of immigrants, or if you came here as a child as an immigrant, it can be really painful for people to be like, wow, you won't ever get this because you weren't technically born here, or you're not into outdoorsy stuff, or, you know, you don't understand this ethos of when you talk to people and when you don't. If your parents were part of the Great Migration, you might not fit into a lot of this stuff. It can really hurt.
Absolutely. And, you know, I see that because I know a lot of people who fit that definition, even though I've always lived in the area. And part of what I was doing with this story was drawing some intentional lines and saying, look, you're not going to technically be in this group unless you were born here, if you've been here for a long time, but you may not want to be. You probably won't want to be. I mean, there was a lot of self-deprecating examination there of all the things that these traits that I described have wrought for us as a society, and many of them are not good, you know, and it was intended really as a send-up of a lot of the things that we believe, in addition to appreciating a lot of the things that we believe. I was hoping people would see both sides of that.
And that's the way, Ron, this is Jonathan, that's the way I read your piece, was that this is really sort of a channeling Emmett Watson of the
sort of
the lesser.
Although Emmett would not have hesitated to say, you're different, therefore, here's what we don't like about you. You know,
well,
that was his shtick, and it was very controversial and very effective. And the funny thing was, this piece was a piece, you know, the 2,200-word piece, 2,100 words of the piece were about natives. But a lot of people read it who were newcomers and said, this is a piece all about us, and I don't like it.
We're all self-absorbed.
Well. Yeah, we all. The lesson I've learned from this is that on both sides, we're self-absorbed. But yeah, I mean, that was the spirit of the piece. An interesting thing happened, which was the Times posted the story online on Friday, as they do, and the headline on the story was very provocative, and it said, basically, if you're not born here, you'll never be one of us. And I did say words to that effect in the story, but that wasn't the point of the story. You know, the actual story, the printed version in the magazine has a headline that says, much more reserved, a survival guide for understanding the Northwest character. And a lot of people who read the story in the magazine in print reacted to it, from my perspective, differently than people who saw it online with that provocative statement. And I think that it sort of just poisoned any open-minded discussion or consideration they were going to have for what was
there. Well, there could also be selection bias there based on who reads in print and who reads online.
I think it's because the headline writer wasn't born here, clearly.
Obviously. Ron, I'm trying to track that person down.
Yeah.
Right now,
but. Do what locals do when you find them or her. Ron Judd, right. Seattle Times, thank you very much.
Sure.
Week in review. Yes, Jonathan?
Well, I was saying about the Emmett Watson reference. I think what Ron is channeling right now is that Seattle is kind of at this inflection point between the old and the new. And we're sort of worshiping right now at the cult of the new, the new industry, the new app, the new tower, the new condo. And Ron is rightly pointing out that there is the old Seattle, that each of these new come at a cost. And I think it's – I was reminded this week with the Kalakala finally being pulled on her was that the time to do this preservation of the old is now, before you have the Kalakala who's finally basically a rusting hunk of scrap.
This is our old ferry boat.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what Ron is talking about, I think, is culturally looking at, you know, we have a neighborhood, we have a town of primarily single-family residences, we have old industry here, and we have a tremendous pressure that's coming in. Anybody who has not been to South Lake Union in the last year, go. It's astonishing that the concentric growth there, and it's entirely driven by the tech industry. Great for jobs, bad for cost of living, bad for cost of housing. And, you know, there is a cost to the new.
We're going to move on the Week in Review. Last word to number one, Melanie, who on Facebook says being a Northwesterner is being able to ski and sail on the same day. Although they say that in L.A. too. I've lived there too. Dan says, finally, complaining about traffic, but then voting down funding measures to implement regional rapid transit and expanded light rail. That's the Northwest to me. We are listening to KUW's Week in Review, coming right back after a break. Coming toward the end of KOW's Week in Review, this is Bill Radke, Eli Sanders, Jonathan Martin, Phyllis Fletcher, Stranger, Seattle Times, Northwest News Network, all represented. And when it comes to prostitution, words matter, said the city attorney this week. The Seattle City Council voted this week unanimously to change the name of the crime, patronizing a prostitute, to sexual exploitation. Phyllis, why the change?
Well, the change, so it wasn't to further criminalize either side, but it was what the city attorney's office and the city council agreed was rewriting the prostitution narrative. So to acknowledge that a lot of people who are on, I guess, what you would call the supply side of prostitution are not doing it of their free will, and the people on the demand side are.
Yeah, so the crime is no longer called patronizing a prostitute, it's sexual exploitation.
Right.
Does anyone else think this potentially is a step toward legalizing? Because if it's no longer a crime to buy sex, it's a crime to exploit. So if the sex worker is licensed and regulated and taxed and has health insurance and minimum wage and affirms that this is voluntary, then it could be legal?
I just got an email about a proposal from Cyrus Habib, who's a legislator on the East Side, to allow the public to offer YouTube testimony on bills like this. So I think you should upload a video about that. Because I have not heard that argument, but that's a creative argument.
Creative, that's what they say when they disagree completely.
It is interesting that we're changing definitions when the crime itself has actually not been prosecuted. So they're switching the titles on the crimes. But I think there was, reading from a Seattle Times editorial, there was 188 cases from January of 2012 to September 2014, when I think we can all agree that there's probably 188 cases of buying sex on a daily basis.
Yes.
So I think that the change in the title is fine. If what you're really talking about is criminalizing this, then let's enforce the law.
Speaking of enforcing the law, this week a white Seattle police officer was suspended for 15 days without pay after using racially charged language while pursuing a black domestic violence suspect downtown. Cairo Radio got the dash cam video from the dashboard of a police car. It shows Officer Jennifer Hunt calling a 32-year-old suspect boy. She admits she used the wrong word but says it had nothing to do with his race, and the police union says it will appeal the punishment, calling it too severe. Seattle Times' Jonathan Martin, the SPD might be moving toward using more cameras. They are testing out body cameras right now. And this week you wrote about the question of whether, is all this footage going to be used to discipline officers or to gather evidence against suspects or both? Will you lay out that controversy?
Yeah, we're at a very interesting point in this whole body, particularly the body cameras issue. You know, on a daily basis, police are collecting just terabytes of data. I mean, you've got video, so much video that it's difficult to process it all, which is why you had that. If you remember a few weeks ago, the Seattle police had a hackathon to help them figure out how they can release the video without having appropriate stuff obscured. But the question here for collecting all of this is, what are we using it for? Are we going to, I think that there's some civil libertarians would say we should only use it to, in a case like this, to discipline a police officer who acted inappropriately. Or are we going to, is a dashboard camera or body cam of somebody walking into a house where you see maybe the camera catches a gun in the corner that the police officer didn't see? And later turns out it's maybe a felon in possession of a firearm. You know, is that video going to be evidentiary, used for evidence?
Is there any case law precedent?
No, this is all, we're in tabula rasa right now. This is all new ground. And I really do hope the legislature takes up this issue of privacy, because what I'm concerned about is that you're going to have cities and counties say, releasing this data is going to bankrupt us. So basically, you're not processing the public disclosure request is going to bankrupt us, so that we're going to have some kind of veil thrown around this video, which I think would be bad precedent, and it would be bad for police reform.
There's another question in the wild world of terabytes of police video of the public, which is, how are you going to blur out the faces of people who shouldn't have their faces released? Either, you know, people who are reporting domestic violence, or people who are just walking by on the street and don't need to be in a video that's released in connection with a crime. Well, they had this a whole bunch of tech programmers come in and advise the police on how to do this. And one guy said, oh, there's a program where you can automatically blur out faces and it works 90% of the time or something like that. Okay, they might start using that. But think about that for a second, and just shows the double-edged sordidness of all of these issues. If you can create a program to automatically go through all this video and blur out faces, in other words, search for particular faces and blur them out, or just search for faces, period, you can program something to go through all this video and find faces of people that you're looking for. In other words, you can turn this into a kind of mass surveillance tool.
By the way, I want to remember that phrase, double-edged sordidness.
Yeah.
That's an excellent phrase.
I was actually hoping that was one of those ungrammatical things that tumble out of my mouth constantly on this show that would just melt into the air.
Oh, it worked. It worked.
Yeah.
I got an image of the Dark Knight. Remember that scene in The Dark Knight where they were turned all the cameras around and Batman was sitting in front of that massive monitor? That sounds so creepy.
The Stranger's Associate Editor Eli Sanders, Jonathan Martin, Opinion Writer at Seattle Times, Phyllis Fletcher is Managing Editor at the Northwest News Network. And before we take a break, just a quick congratulations to Amazon. Their streaming show, Transparent, wins for a Best TV Comedy, even though it's not on TV. Best Actor, Jeffrey Tambor. And not only that, it's a sensitive portrayal of a transgender father, which has, and we haven't used the phrase Amazon and sensitive or progressive in quite a while. By the way, there's an author who says, this excellent show doesn't make Amazon a friend of creative content. Even Napoleon had some mighty fine-looking uniforms. So, you know, the jury is still out. And then Amazon signed Woody Allen to create a show, a whole season of 30-minute programs that he's going to write and direct. And he said, Woody Allen said, I don't know how I got into this. I have no ideas, and I'm not sure where to begin. My guess is that Amazon Studios Vice President Roy Price will regret this. Right now, the thing is called Untitled Woody Allen Project. Woody Allen has been saying that about himself for 50 years now.
Yeah.
I love that.
They should keep that title, by the way. That's tight.
Just call it Untitled Woody Allen Project?
Yeah.
If you're looking for inspiration, Woody, the European Union today announced that Amazon may have set up an illegal tax dodge in Luxembourg.
It's a travesty of a mockery of a sham of a mockery of a travesty of two mockeries of a sham.
So there's that. Take the money and run. Right back with one of the greatest runners there is on Week in Review. Not a great talker, or is he? Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Phyllis Fletcher, Eli Sanders, Jonathan Martin, and more. Now, we don't cover sports much on KUOW, as it should be. But every once in a while, sports accidentally sheds light on human nature. And then we are there. This week, a Seattle Seahawks fan started a petition calling on the NFL and the media to
leave
Marshawn Lynch
alone.
Leave him alone. This is the Seahawks star running back. This petition filed on GoPetition.com is called Enough is Enough, Stop Bullying Beast Mode. And it demands that the NFL stop forcing Marshawn Lynch to talk to the media. Seattle Times sports reporter Percy Allen joins us. Hi, Percy.
Hi, Bill.
So, the background, just to catch everybody up, Marshawn Lynch has been fined $100,000 for not talking to reporters after the games. So he started talking, but only in very short answers.
I don't know.
Are you surprised at how much more attention you get for not talking than if you ever just talk like this?
I don't know.
The man said he doesn't know, but this happens over and over again And so you might think reporters would quit bothering him. But after last weekend's victory over the Carolina Panthers, there they were asking him questions.
Y'all want to try again, huh? So y'all going to try again? That's what we're going to do. We're going to try one more time.
He obviously doesn't want to talk, Percy. So if you're going to ask him something, of course it's going to be really thoughtfully considered.
I'm trying to talk about the celebration dance at the Cam Chancellor's touchdown.
That question was, Marshawn, talk about the celebration dance after Cam Chancellor's touchdown, which is not a question.
Okay.
It's an order.
Right.
At this point, now, Percy, you've seen this video, unless you were there in person.
Yes, I've seen the video. Yes.
Okay. So Marshawn is blinking. He's grimacing. He looks like he might cry. Right? The sweatshirt is pulled up halfway over his face,
okay.
And the reporters will not stop.
Talk about your performance in the second half, the big run.
I'm thankful.
I'm thankful. Marshawn, what was the team's approach to this win?
I'm thankful.
When's your next charity event?
I'm thankful.
What was the song of the day on the way to the game, Marshawn?
I'm thankful.
Percy, please speak for all sports reporters. You've been there. You've covered the Seahawks. You've talked to Marshawn Lynch. Why will you not leave the man alone?
You really need to stop.
I'm done.
You really need to stop.
I had to set that up.
This is, come on. Are you all right? So first off, I must say, as a disclaimer, I'm probably not the best person to speak on this issue, you know, but you asked me to be here, so I show up.
Why are you not the best? We talked about this.
Well, you know, probably some a representative from the NFL would probably be best suited to talk about their policy.
I want to know why you, as a reporter, go up and keep talking to someone who doesn't want to talk.
You know, I just find it humorous that you frame the art or the conversation that way, as if we're attacking this poor sort of individual there, which you know. Is not true. So first off, and you know, to be real here, I could care less if Marshawn Lynch or Russell Wilson or Pete Carroll never speaks to the media. That is their prerogative. Fine. It makes my job a little bit more difficult, but not impossible. So now, that being said, I can speak to the rules of the NFL, and the rules are clear. It just says that that players will be available after games and once during the week. It's not a whole lot to ask for. And now that's the NFL's rules. It's not anybody else's rules. So you have one individual, you know, in a union of what, 32 teams, 53 players per team, you know, so, you know, in thousands of people inside that union who is doing something different than everybody else. Mm-hmm. That's all.
Okay, and one more thing is that you told me that I'm exaggerating how uncomfortable Marshawn Lynch is about talking to people.
Yes, and
this is what I didn't know, and I'm fascinated.
Well, so the clips that you sort of cut there, which were entertaining and, you know, great, but... But I've also seen Marshawn in other sort of places where he's very articulate, where he's funny, where he's very passionate. You put him in a different venue, and he's talking about his foundation, his charity, and really, you can't shut him up.
For example, when he's talking to KCPQ this week about his charity youth camp.
We have doctors come, we have lawyers come, financial advisors come to the camp, and we have them talk to the kids rather than the athletes to let them know that there's many more fields out there that you could go and get into, to where you can still make money and you can still bring a positive light back to your family, something that they can be proud of.
I've seen that dude, you know. So basically what I see is just somebody who just doesn't want to talk to the media, and he wants it on his own terms. And I'm sorry, the NFL just doesn't operate that way. Hey, look, it's a $45 billion industry, and they kind of know what they're doing, and they want their players to promote their product. That's the bottom line.
I love it. I think he's the best self-promoter of all time. First of all, the gold vest was tight. You got to watch that video. Second of all, it's exciting every time. I mean, most of the time these videos are just like, oh, we tried to win and we did. Oh, thank you. Oh, good. And they're not even like, if you listen to the question or so-called question and the answer, they're like skewed lines and space.
Yes.
This is like fun and exciting.
Are you self-promoter? Are you saying that he has brilliantly manipulated the system so that he is the most sought after. He's getting the most attention while at the same time acting like he doesn't want it.
I don't know what the intention was, I love the result. Yeah. I think it's great, and I can't wait to see what the next answer is. It's awesome.
Okay.
Contrast with the sort of the automaton answers of Russell Wilson, that he says the same platitudes over and over again. He seems like Marshawn's just being, he's almost a performance art in contrast.
Yeah. He's being a real Seattleite.
I'm
not going to look at you.
Performance art.
Yeah, totally.
Well, and that's what's great about that. I think that we don't care, because I think it's a town where you kind of come as you are town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I've got everybody in my neighborhood knows exactly where Dave Matthews lives.
Right.
You know, he goes, walks in the QFC. Everybody ignores him, you know, or gives him kind of a wink. And we don't really give a rip. There's billionaires and, you know, in jeans walking around. And
that's what I'm saying. a true Northwesterner leaves Dave Matthews.
Alone.
Percy Allen from the Seattle Times, thanks for coming by.
I don't know why we're talking about this.
A sports reporter doesn't even know why we're talking about this. Because the Seattle Seahawks play Green Bay this weekend on Sunday, and we're all excited about it. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm convinced. I've been turned around on it. Jonathan Martin, Seattle Times opinion writer, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, appreciate
nice to
it.
Be here.
Phyllis Fletcher, managing editor of Northwest News Network, thank you.
Thanks for asking.
KUOW's Week in Review is produced by Jason Pagano. And keep talking with us on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, Twitter, at KUOW. We'll be back again next week with another great show that Percy Allen does not appreciate. Stay tuned.